listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. While the U.S. media is gushing over the supposed fall of Baghdad and the regime of Saddam Hussein, the Middle East is nervous and tense about the fate of its future. Already, Bush superhawks and the Israeli government, headed by Ariel Sharon, are calling for an attack on Iran. And there has been a steady stream of Western media and pundit attacks on the government of Syria, accusing it of funding terrorist activities while trying to put a friendly spin on U.S. aggression. Joining us to talk about U.S. plans to occupy and dominate the Middle East are Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emerita of Sociology at Simmons College, writer, investigative reporter Larry Everest. Everest is the author of the forthcoming book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. That's forthcoming from Common Perridge Press. And also joining the discussion is Asad Abu Khalil. Khalil is a widely published author and a professor of political science at the California State University in Stanislaus. Welcome, everybody. Let me begin with you, if I could, Professor Hagopian. Given the vitriol we're now seeing coming out of the U.S. against Syria and Iran, and the fact that Iranians, Syrians, Jordanians have already died in the ongoing U.S.-British attack, is this military invasion of Iraq just the opening salvo on the region?
Well, according to Noam Chomsky, it's a trial run. And if it's successful, they may try some other things. My own sense is that they are really working to try to topple the regimes in Syria and in Iran, primarily in Iran, by hoping there would be a quote-unquote some sort of uprising. In Syria, I think they know that they're isolating Syria and they're making Syria very uneasy. What I would like to point out here is that there is a great deal of talk now about running the pipeline from Iraq to Haifa. And one scenario is that it would go through Syria, but Syria would have to agree. And if Syria didn't agree, there may be some pressure on it for some sort of a regime change or change of attitude, or the pipeline might go through Jordan. In any case, I personally don't think that they will ever want to have a settlement according to this roadmap, which includes supposedly the Golan Heights. I think the map is going to be changed permanently if the hawks can push it through and if they insist on doing it, and this is one of their most fanciful plans ever.
Well, Professor Hagopian, just remind people what pipeline you're talking about here.
There was the oil pipeline from Iraq goes through Syria at this point. And before 1948, there used to be a pipeline to Haifa. And after 48, that went into disuse. And now that would, if the pipeline again went to Haifa, to the Haifa port, this would assure Israel of a very good oil supply. They wouldn't have to rely on outside sources. And it would also guarantee the U.S. A supply that would come right through their ally Israel and come right out of Iraq. And so it's a very lucrative business. It would mean repairing the pipelines. It would be a lot of business people running in there and basically trying to take a cut of the pie.
Asad Abu Khalil, is this the opening salvo or is this an end game here?
No, I do not think so. I think that there is a great appetite on the part of these people who run the government of the United States to engage in more adventures in hoping that they will change the regimes of the region. They'll make it all nice for Israel to continue to prevail and expand. But I think that what happened in Iraq, despite the footage of today, and we can comment about that more critically and cynically than what we hear on the news, will have indicated to them that even if Iraq, which has suffered from so many wars, Iran-Iraq war, the occupation of Kuwait, and 91 war, and from 91 till today, this country has been bombed repeatedly, subject to stiff sanctions. The people are exhausted by virtue of the oppression under Saddam, as well as America's war on Iraqis, military war and economic war. And as a result, I mean, they were surprised it was not a cakewalk, so to speak. So for that reason, they realize if they want to take the battle to Syria or to Iran, it is going to be a much, much messier affair than they would have hoped for. This is not to say that U.S. plans in the Middle East do not entail a lot of subversion as well as manipulation of governments, as well as various forces. But I don't think things will go according to their plans. If anything, even the Iraqi part of what they have planned may very well turn against their plans in a very short period of time.
Larry Everest, opening salvo.
Yeah, I just taking up where Assad left off. I think we're seeing the clash of two titanic forces. One is the masses of people throughout the Middle East, and as Assad mentioned, they made sure that this was not a cakewalk, versus these very grand, enormous ambitions of the people running the United States government. Just a few days ago, James Woolsey, former head of the CIA, part of the defense policy board that's been pushing war on Iraq since the hours after September 11th, 2001, gave a presentation at UCLA, and he said this war on Iraq is the opening salvo of World War IV. It's going to go on for years. He immediately targeted Syria and Iran as being part of the next phase of this. And I think we have to understand that the reason that the Bush administration has focused so heavily on Iraq, has been so determined, is that they see it as a key part of this plan that they have articulated for global domination. Conquering and occupying Iraq, which is what they're doing, as we'll discuss, number one, eliminates a regime that had been a problem for them in the Persian Gulf. Number two, they hope to turn it into a platform to transform the whole Middle East and strengthen U.S. control of that whole region by eliminating regimes like Syria and Iran that are not fully in the U.S. orbit, by crushing the struggle of the Palestinian people, even by restructuring regimes, client regimes like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states that they consider unreliable at this point. And this opens the door to even broader global objectives, for example, controlling world energy sources in the Middle East and in Central Asia, which are key to this whole plan for the U.S. to be the world's dominant superpower and not allow countries like Russia, like France, like China, to rise to challenge the U.S.
All right, let's take it back directly to Iraq now in terms of what's happening there on the ground and how that forebodes or tells us about what's in store in terms of the U.S. attempt to dominate the region. And I'd like to begin by doing a quick round with the three of you in terms of the images we're seeing today. What's your response to what we're hearing on the ground? I was interested to hear Ann Garrels of NPR refer to say that the looting, there was a lot of looting, but it was not violent looting.
Well, the two things strike me as, first, we're seeing some scenes of people celebrating, but we're not seeing scenes of people who are still fighting and the many scenes of people who've been massacred, either because their civilians and their homes have been bombed or the people who've been killed fighting the U.S. The other thing, and Assad mentioned this, look, Iraq has been under siege for 13 years. People have been starved. People have been deprived medicine and water. And, of course, this is never mentioned when the U.S. reporters are in Basra wondering why the people there don't have enough water, the impact of U.S. sanctions and the destruction of the water system. So no doubt there are Iraqis who are so desperate they simply want this nightmare to be ended, and they're clinging to the hope that the U.S. may bring some sort of relief from this war.
Assad Abu Khalil, the response just to the images today.
The images. I think that a lot of people will disagree with me when I say this. And I didn't hear anybody saying that even in the Arabic media this morning. And I usually do not resort to conspiracy theorists, but let me say this. Don't be surprised if a year or two or three, Bob Woodward comes out with a book in which we learn that the scene today, as I was watching it on Al Jazeera this morning, struck me as too theatrical, too orchestrated, and not really genuine. And I really believe, personally, I have no evidence, of course. I will not be surprised if this was arranged by the CIA and some of the people from the Iraqi National Congress, because its symbolic effect will be great to basically send a message that the regime is crumbling. And I also noticed that, I mean, how did this occur? Like, people were walking spontaneously, and they were in their back pockets, had hammers and sledgehammers, because they, whenever they stroll down the street, they do that. And there were all these fightings in Baghdad, and people felt safe. Let us just gather walk and just, like, pull down the statue of Saddam Hussein. So I'm very skeptical about this. It's not to say that there is not relief for people to get rid of a brutal dictatorship. I'm not saying that. But I also want to say that when people live under a brutal occupation like this one is, after being bombed from the air and sea and everywhere else for 21 days, I mean, of course they're going to be intimidated, and they're going to kiss the shoes, literally, of their occupiers. I've seen those scenes myself in South Lebanon when the Israelis came. Within 1 year, instead of showering them with sprays, they were tossing grenades at their convoys. And I also noticed one last point. As I was watching interviews with people in Basra, for example, whenever they are interviewed by Western journalists who are always embedded and surrounded by heavily armed U.S. troops, they say rather cautious, nice things like, we're really happy, there's no problem. But I notice when they speak to Abu Dhabi TV and Al Jazeera TV, they are very critical of the American and the British. And some of them, just yesterday I was watching this on Abu Dhabi TV, some of them even expressed the views like, this is getting worse than the times of under Saddam Hussein. So this is not to say that we should go back to the times of Saddam's tyranny, but I'm saying that I think very quickly the Iraqis will come to the realization, inevitable, that the United States absolutely doesn't have the true interests of the Iraqi people at heart, that they have intentions not only of oil, but of domination, that there is no interest in democracy. And I agree with Larry's interest except one point. The United States is not going to bother Saudi Arabia whatsoever. The message in the Middle East is very clear. If you continue to oppress and persecute and torture your own people who happen to be opposed to the United States, we'll shower you with praise, aid, and support. But if you ever happen to oppose U.S. foreign policy and economic interests, and if you ever persecute somebody who is pro-American and is in favor of peace with Israel, then we'll go after you.
And Professor Hakobian, what's your response to what we're seeing unfold now?
Well, I think Assad has put it very well, and I think that it may have been something that was manufactured. On the other hand, if there was anything genuine about it at all, take a look. The numbers were not that great, and always when you have a camera on a small group, it tries to make it appear as though it was general throughout the area. But my sense is that they have been now moving in this so-called interim government with Ghana, and they, as you know, this crook Shalabi is in Nasiriyah, and he is determined that he wants to somehow be a big part of what's going on.
You say crook, is that hyperbole?
I think no. He's a guy who started Petrobank in Amman and then embezzled all the money and fled.
Elaine is totally accurate when she says that. This person not only is convicted by a Jordanian court of embezzling millions of dollars of people's savings, and he has to flee the country since the 1980s, but we have to remember that a State Department report from last year accused him of so-called mismanagement of funds, which is basically another word for embezzlement, but it was only the pressure from the Vice President and the Defense Department and the White House that allowed him to continue. So don't be surprised if in the future we learn that some of the goons of Shalabi that he brought with him to Nasiriyah were the ones who brought the hammers to do the job today in Baghdad. Of course, this is not to shed any tears for the collapse of the statues of that dictator or for the fall of Saddam Hussein. But we have to be very careful. We are bombarded with the propaganda, the likes of which we've never seen since the Second World War. This is something that a famous French journalist, Eric Rollot, said in Le Monde Diplomatique 2 months ago. We have to be very careful about what we're getting. This is part of the psychological operation of the United States government. I mean, that's part of war. And if they spend $75 million, according to Bob Woodward's book, in the war in Afghanistan to buy the loyalty of tribes or to rent the loyalty of tribes, because now many of them are shifting loyalties, I mean, the charade of today on the news, that would have cost only a few thousand dollars. This is a starving population.
And Professor Hakobian, we interrupted you. You were going on from Shalabi.
Well, I think Shalabi is there, and as you know, he's determined. And as you also know, the Pentagon wants him. And the Pentagon people under Rumsfeld, and then you have Wolfowitz, want him because this guy is very, very close to Israel. And he along with Garner, but Shalabi wants his own piece of the pie. He wants to be the big wheel. He has visited Israel recently, and he has promised to recognize Israel. And this, of course, would not sit well with the Iraqi people. And the point here is the issue of recognition of Israel and normalization is that Israel seeks to be normalized and to be a sub-imperial power in the area under the umbrella of the U.S. without having to concede anything for being a colonial settler state, without conceding anything to the Palestinians. And all this roadmap talk is nonsense. Blair may take it seriously, but the U.S. does not.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're talking about U.S. plans to occupy and dominate the Middle East. And we're speaking with Elaine Hakobian. She's a professor emerita of sociology at Simmons College. Also joining the discussion is Asad Abu Khalil. He's a widely published author, professor of political science at the California State University. And also in the studio with us is Larry Everest. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Oil Power and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, let's talk a little bit more about U.S. long-range plans, policies, strategies for dominating. What are you seeing? What are the snapshots here?
The snapshots are a new form of colonialism that's exactly the opposite of any sort of democracy or liberation. In fact, it's robbing the Iraqi people of their right to determine their own future. Let's start with oil. The United States is talking about putting the former head of Shell Oil, U.S., in charge of Iraq's oil, a guy named Philip Carroll. His assistant would be the British Petroleum head, Rodney Chase, from the United States. Back in October, the White House called together a team of 12 to 20 people. This was reported in Oil and Gas Journal, that was doing a complete reevaluation of the position of Iraq's oil industry, who would get to invest in it, how much it would produce, who it would be sold to. So that's one facet. But there are other facets as well. You know, it's not getting much media publicity, but there are already lawyers. There was one report that there are lawyers in Iraq now preparing martial law. Civilians are being rounded up in Nasiriyah. The over 300 Iraqi civilians, and of course this brings to mind images of the West Bank and Gaza. A Pentagon lawyer, Michael Mobbs, and he's the guy that came out with a legal theory that the United States had the right to transport prisoners from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay, and that the U.S. government could imprison anyone without charges if they were deemed an enemy combatant. He's going to be the head of civilian administration. That means he's going to head 11 of the 23 departments of the Iraqi administration. And of those 23, just note that they're all going to be run by Americans with a few Iraqi assistants. The U.S. is talking about changing the Iraqi currency. And one of the things that really got to me was that the U.S. is going to be rewriting the textbooks that Iraqi children read in school and eliminating references to the oppression of U.S. imperialism and eliminating support for Iraqi nationalism.
Asad, you want to jump in here?
I mean, I concur entirely with what Larry has been saying. I think that the intentions and the plans are really gruesome. And we have to remember, as Elaine was saying, I mean, the Iraqi people have very strong credentials about the Palestinian question. This is an Arab nationalist country. Yes, Saddam Hussein tried to hijack it, but the political culture of Iraq, with strong Arab nationalism, strong sympathy for the Palestinian remains, and you have the gang of the Iraqi National Congress, as Elaine was saying, with strong close to Israel. And just last week we learned, this was kept secretly, but now it's revealed in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, none other than one of the people who is really adored by the American press, Kanaan Makiya, apparently was a special guest at the conference of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington, D.C. Those people will not be able to go in Baghdad and be greeted. And I'll tell you something. If it took tens of troops to keep Hamid Karzai alive, it's going to take so many more American troops to keep the gang of Shalabi and those people alive in Iraq. And I think that the intention of these rewriting the school textbooks and basically charting a new course for Iraq, and the special report that Kanaan Makiya wrote, which is available on the website of the American Enterprise Institute, I mean, this is incredible. He has in this plan the idea that Iraq will not be allowed to be an Arab country. And in fact, when I wrote against that in an Arabic newspaper, Al Hayat, revealing this to the Arabic readers about what they have to intend to Iraq, he wrote back. I mean, he wrote in English, but they have to translate his words because he cannot speak Arabic. And in that article, he said that he denied that he said those words. Of course, the words remain there on the website for anybody to see.
That's true that he said that. And as a matter of fact, he was recently on The Connection, which is an NPR program here in Boston, in which he talked about the fact that this would not be an Arab country because it's so diverse.
That's right.
Believe in ethnicity.
Well, and today a State Department official said the first act of the new Iraqi government should be to recognize Israel.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is a main purpose. And Kanan Makia has, when he wrote his first book under a pseudonym on Iraq, he actually did some of his research in Israel. I know Kanan and I know Ahmed. They were students at MIT. And in those days, I met most of the Arab students. And it's very interesting that Shadabi came about 3 or 4 years ago to speak at Harvard. And he recognized that I went to that program. And he avoided calling on me. And then after a while, he had to. And I asked him, I said, do you think that if you become head of Iraq, under the auspices of the U.S., that you would have an independent domestic and foreign policy? And he said, oh, yes, of course I would. Nick, sitting right next to him, was at that time a pro-CIA guy for Shalabi. And I said to him, well, what is this guy doing sitting next to you? Oh, well, they're our friends. They're going to help facilitate this. So these people are, you know, just wheel of deals. Kanan Makia is this very soft-spoken guy who tries to come across as humane and gentle.
Right.
And tries to promote the idea that after Iraq becomes democratic, the whole place will fall into democracy.
That's right.
And that the U.S. intentions are really so really benevolent. Now, I would like to point out a couple of other things here, is that there's even been talk about the artwork of Iraq, and already the big art dealers are meeting in Washington to discuss with the various offices the possibility of getting hold of some of that art, of having easier access to it for their own collections as well as museums, etc. And then, of course, we also know, and I think Larry alluded to this, that the U.S. has been very much concerned about the fact that Iraq in the year 2000 had changed over to the euro as the main oil currency. Iran has changed over in much of its financial dealings and also may change its oil petrodollars in for euros. Venezuela is the same, and they are concerned that the euro will become competitive and in fact become the standard currency. And the U.S. is seeking to reverse that because obviously it would mean that the U.S. dollar would no longer be the world currency, and it would in many ways affect our economy, affect our purchasing power, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me jump in here, yeah. Professor Hogobiam, because we only have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to address finally how Israel, a little bit more about how Israel fits into this picture, considering that the occupying general is not only openly supportive of the Israeli hardline right, but has condemned the Palestinian struggle. Let's start with you, Assad. Very quickly respond to this.
I just want to say that it's an important element which will only raise the suspicion of the Arab people as well as the Iraqis before that. I also want to say something because I haven't heard that said on the news. I listened carefully today to some what of the people were saying in that very square we were watching live, and I noticed all the slogans that were declared were religious slogans in nature. So I also think to myself that after all these years of a brutal regime, but a regime that was very secular in nature, we will witness new politics, and it's not going to be Iraqi National Congress. It's going to be religious fundamentalists among Sunnis and Shiites alike. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, after the Soviet occupation, we have the fundamentalist groups from which came the Taliban. Israel occupation South Lebanon produced also the Hezbollah Party of God in Lebanon. And we may very well, because of the American occupation, witness the production of a new fundamentalist groups among Shiites and Sunnis, who eventually will be far from cheering U.S. occupation of their land.
And Professor Hagobian, what about the Israeli part of this puzzle?
I think it's a very important piece because every one of the neocons in government have some connection with Israel. And as Christensen in her article, along with her husband, the former CIA people, in Counterpunch pointed out, their passions are so strong for Israel that they often run closer to Israeli interests and don't cross that line into Israeli interests beyond American interests. But they have worked very hard to mesh these two. And because Israel has always been, quote-unquote, the special ally of the U.S. in the Middle East, it was, in a sense, somewhat easy to do, but it has never been quite so blatant. I think in the past, and I need to say this very quickly, in the past, the U.S. policy used to try to take the Arab sensibilities into account. They didn't do it well. They didn't do it often. They didn't do it all the time. But occasionally they would give a nod to Arab sensibilities. This administration, under these people, with their big plans for the world, is not giving any nod to Arab sensibilities. As a matter of fact, it's saying, if you don't shape up and do what we tell you to do and behave, we'll just knock you out.
Now, you're talking about people like Elliot Abrams,
yes.
Who, a former Iran-Contra criminal who was pardoned, and he's an interesting guy because his role back in Iran-Contra days was to cover up mass murder and slaughters in Central America, and we can already see that he's playing this similar role in Iraq and in Israel.
This is correct, and I think a very important point that we need to make here is that there are a whole host of what I call two tiers of institutions. There is the American Enterprise Institute, there's JINSA, Americans for Victory over Terrorism, which is an offshoot of these other characters. There's the Hudson Institute. These are the big think tanks that try to sort of define and shape policy, and which all the characters in government more or less have relationships with them. And then there is a second tier, which is like the Middle East Forum of Daniel Pipes and his and the offshoot, which is really produced by Pipes's group, is the investigative project of Stephen Emerson, who has been caught lying so many times about the Islamic world, and yet there he is again. And there are a whole host of these second-tier groups constantly making this a clash of civilizations and demonizing Islam. And what they're doing, in a sense, is they are forcing the situation to become, in a sense, not that, but rather to use the Islamist movement to have political redress. The issue is political.
All right, let me jump in here. Final word, Larry Evrist.
I think we're seeing a very sharpening clash, not between civilizations, but between imperialism led by the U.S. with its close ally Israel against the masses of people in the Middle East. If you want to crush the Arab people's struggle for self-determination, which is the vanguard of which is the struggle of the Palestinian people, if you want to intimidate the masses and these other governments throughout the region, if you want to increase the direct U.S. military presence in this energy heart of the world where still 65% of the oil and natural gas reserves lie, your best ally in that is going to be Israel. So what we're seeing is a synergy, a coincidence between the agenda of the Israeli right for a greater Israel and the agenda of the U.S. rulers for a greater U.S. domination of the planet.
And we are smack out of time. That was the voice of Larry Evrist. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Also with us was Professor Aline Hogobian, Professor Emerita of Sociology at Simmons College, and our good friend Asad Abu Khalil. He's a widely published author, Professor of Political Science at the California State University in Stanislaus. Thanks to all three of you for a very interesting and informative discussion. And we're going to go to Moscow after a musical break.